This CLE is based on the New York State appellate decisions released in April 2020 that deal with issues related to negligence. The summaries of the decisions were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in April 2020. They've since been compiled into the April 2020 Negligence Update pamphlet, and it is that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for the CLE. And the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 3, Lloyd's Syndicate. It's a legal malpractice case, and it discusses the major issues in legal malpractice. So I think it's worth just going through those issues. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's attorney's motion to dismiss the legal malpractice complaint based upon documentary evidence should have been granted. The plaintiff's insurers alleged the defendants negligently advised them to disclaim insurance coverage. The court wrote, plaintiffs alleged that they sustained damages when they relied on defendants' negligent advice that they could disclaim coverage of their insured. In support of their motion to dismiss, defendants properly relied on documentary evidence, including the challenged disclaimer letter and the relevant policy, since their authenticity is undisputed and their contents are essentially undeniable. And it was citing CPLR 3211. The disclaimer letter sets forth an analysis of plaintiffs' right to refuse coverage to their insured on two independent bases. Plaintiff's failure to allege with specificity or argue that one of the two bases for defendant's advice was incorrect requires dismissal of the legal malpractice action. Aside from this, defendant's alleged malpractice concerning other issues is subject to the attorney judgment rule, since plaintiffs failed to show that the issues were elementary or subject to settled authority. Defendants could not be liable for malpractice based on their prediction of how a court would interpret the policy. Further, plaintiff's failure to explain how it was that any alleged error by defendants prejudiced their defense in the subsequent coverage action also mandates dismissal of the malpractice claim. Next is Rudle, R-U-D-L-E, versus Schifrin on page 4. It's a medical malpractice action, and it has to do with impeachment evidence that was allowed in to impeach the credibility of the defendant doctor. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this medical malpractice action, held the defendant doctor's motion to set aside the plaintiff's $400,000 verdict should have been granted. The trial court should not have allowed extrinsic documentary evidence on collateral matters to impeach defendant's credibility. The court wrote, the Supreme Court should not have permitted the plaintiff to introduce extrinsic documentary evidence concerning collateral matters solely for the purpose of impeaching the defendant's credibility. In view of the importance of the defendant's testimony and the emphasis given to the improperly admitted credibility evidence by the plaintiff's counsel during summation, the errors were sufficiently prejudicial to warrant a new trial. Next is McGuire versus Upstate Auto on pages 5 and 6. It's a negligent entrustment action. The basic facts were that the plaintiff's decedent took a scooter that was apparently offered for sale by the defendants on a test drive, and she was killed. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court in this negligent entrustment action, held there were questions of fact whether defendant had dominion and control over a scooter which was for sale at a car dealership and therefore owned the scooter, whether defendant knew decedent was not competent to operate the scooter, and whether defendant gave the decedent permission to take the scooter for a test drive. Decedent was killed in an accident when she was taking the test drive. The court wrote, an owner of a motor vehicle may be liable for negligent entrustment if he or she was negligent in entrusting it to one who he or she knew or in the exercise of ordinary care should have known was incompetent to operate it. The dealership owner stated in an affidavit that neither his father nor defendant, the dealership, owned the scooter. Nevertheless, the scooter was displayed for sale on defendant's front lot, and the owner stated in his deposition testimony that he would push the scooter from the garage to the lot each morning. The keys for the scooter would be in the scooter when it was on display in the lot, and then were kept in a separate box behind the owner's desk when it was not on display. The helmet was likewise kept in the office of the owner's father. Viewing the foregoing evidence in the light most favorable to plaintiff, we conclude that a question of fact exists as to whether defendant exerted dominion and control over the scooter so as to be its owner. Defendant alternatively argues that it did not have knowledge that decedent was incompetent to operate the scooter. The owner stated that he thought decedent had a motorcycle permit, but he did not confirm this fact with decedent, nor did he inquire as to whether she knew how to drive the scooter. The owner also did not check decedent's driver's permit or have her sign anything prior to when she drove the scooter. Other than knowing that decedent had ridden a two-wheel Yamaha Enduro road bike in the past, the owner had never seen decedent operate a scooter prior to the accident. In view of this evidence, we find that there is an issue of fact regarding whether the owner should have known that decedent was incompetent to ride the scooter. The owner admitted that, other than verbally telling decedent to wait for his father, he did not do anything else to try to stop decedent from taking the scooter. Indeed, when asked what he did when decedent walked into his father's office and took the helmet for the scooter, the owner responded, nothing. A customer who was with the owner when decedent arrived testified that it appeared that decedent did not take the scooter against the owner's will and that it looked like there was some sort of agreement because she did go. Next is Harkins versus Tuma on page 6. It's a slip and fall case, landlord-tenant. There's an out-of-possession landlord issue. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether defendant out-of-possession landlord is liable for plaintiff's slip and fall on ice on a step leading to her apartment, despite it being plaintiff's responsibility to remove ice and snow from the area. Plaintiff alleged the ice formed because of a leak in the porch roof. The court wrote, a landlord has a duty to use ordinary care to keep those areas which are reserved and intended for the common use of the tenants and owner of the building and subject to the landlord's control, that being the common areas, in a reasonably safe and suitable condition. The roof here was not accessible or available for use by the tenants, but the record indicates that the exterior of the building may have been within defendant's control. Since purchasing the building in 1994, defendants had replaced the roof, replaced the gutter system along at least one side of the building, and recoated part of the roof with tar. Defendant, Timothy J. Charest, who was responsible for managing the property, testified that the gutter system was on the building when defendants purchased the property, but also testified that if there were problems with the gutter on the side of the building containing the apartment entrances, there were repairs made, though he could not remember when any such repairs had been made. Charest testified that he inspected the property approximately weekly, as well as after every storm. He did not keep records of his inspections, but would do them on a weekday. Plaintiff's accident occurred on a Friday evening. Neither defendant could specifically identify when he had last inspected the property. So again, because the ice formed, at least allegedly, because of a leak in the roof and the tenants did not have responsibility for the roof, the out-of-possession landlord's motion for summary judgment was denied. Next is Dembele on page 7. It's another slip and fall, this time involving municipal law as well as landlord-tenant issues. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant owner of the property leased by a restaurant had a non-delegable duty to keep a metal ramp leading from the restaurant to the sidewalk, which is considered a special use of the sidewalk, in a safe condition, notwithstanding the restaurant's lease obligation to remove ice and snow from the sidewalk. Plaintiff, a restaurant employee, slipped and fell on snow and ice on the ramp. The court wrote, plaintiff, an employee of the restaurant owned by a third-party defendant, slipped and fell on snow and ice on a metal ramp leading from the side door of the restaurant to the sidewalk. Third-party defendant leases the ground floor and basement space from defendant landowner. The evidence shows that the ramp was erected over the public sidewalk alongside defendant's building and is not included in the diagram of the leased space. Further, the director of leasing for defendant's property manager testified that the ramp was built for use by people with disabilities. Notwithstanding any lease provisions obligating the restaurant to remove snow and ice from the sidewalk, defendant, as owner of the property abutting the sidewalk, had a non-delegable duty to keep the sidewalk and any special uses made of the sidewalk in a safe condition, including the removal of snow and ice. Next is Reich versus Alexander's Incorporated. It's on pages 7 and 8. It's another slip and fall case, this time involving a trivial defect issue. Second Department held the defect which caused plaintiff's slip and fall was trivial as a matter of law. The court wrote, the plaintiff testified that he stopped by one of the benches, and when he started to walk away, his foot got caught under the bench leg. The plaintiff further testified that he returned to the site of the accident later that day and observed that the bench leg, which had allegedly caught his foot, was bent and protruding outward approximately 2 inches into the pedestrian walkway. The plaintiff, who had frequented that mall more than 100 times and had previously been to the area of the mall where the accident had occurred, had never noticed the bent bench leg. No one, including the plaintiff, had ever complained about the bent bench leg to the defendants, nor had any prior accidents involving the bent bench leg been reported to the defendants. The plaintiff's engineering expert opined that the defendants were negligent in permitting the bench leg to protrude into the pedestrian walkway so as to create a tripping hazard. Here, the evidence that the defendant submitted in support of their motion, including several photographs of the alleged defect, established prima facie that, as a matter of law, under all the circumstances, including the lighting conditions at the time of the accident, the plaintiff's unobstructed view of the alleged defect, and the condition and location of the bench leg, the alleged defect was trivial and therefore not actionable. Next is Kuti versus Sarah Security Services on pages 8 and 9. It's a third-party assault case. First Department held defendant security companies, that's Sarah's, motion for summary judgment in this patient assault case was properly denied. Plaintiff, a nurse at a healthcare facility, was assaulted by a patient. Sarah argued it was only responsible for providing protection against intruders, not patients. Because the contract with Sarah was ambiguous, the court properly considered extrinsic evidence, which was deposition testimony, which indicated Sarah responded to staff's calls for help dealing with patient altercations or fighting. There were questions of fact whether plaintiff was a third-party beneficiary of Sarah's contract with the facility, and whether plaintiff detrimentally relied on Sarah to protect her from the assault. Questions of fact about Sarah's duty to plaintiff and the foreseeability of the assault were also raised. The court wrote, the motion court properly concluded that plaintiff raised questions of fact sufficient to overcome summary judgment as to whether Sarah is liable to plaintiff under a theory of detrimental reliance based on plaintiff's allegation that the Sarah security guard promised to respond to plaintiff's call for assistance but failed to do so in a timely manner or failed to call the police promptly or at all. Defendant's security guard testified that he could not recall when he received the call from his colleague directing him to go to the floor where plaintiff worked, whether he was advised of any details of what was occurring or how long it took him to get there. He further testified that he was trained to investigate calls prior to determining whether to call the police, and that if a staff member called the security station about an incident, it was the Sarah security guard's responsibility to call 911 or the police when warranted. Next is Musano versus City of New York. It's another third-party assault case, this time involving municipal law. First Department held plaintiff's social worker's suit against the city, based on a tenant's menacing her with a knife, was properly dismissed. The incident happened at city housing for mentally ill and homeless persons. The court wrote, "The court correctly concluded that the city defendants were acting in a governmental capacity when they provided funding for the facility and its services. A party seeking to impose liability on a municipality acting in a governmental capacity must establish the existence of a special duty to plaintiff, which is more than the duty owed to the public generally. Here, plaintiff presented no evidence that would provide a basis for finding that a special duty was owed to her by the city defendants. Regarding defendant's owner and managing agent of the premises, a landowner must act as a reasonable person in maintaining the property in a reasonably safe condition in view of all the circumstances, including the likelihood of injury to others, the seriousness of the injury, and the burden of avoiding the risk. The owner and managing agent demonstrated that the incident was not reasonably foreseeable, and that the tenant was a resident in the facility for 9 years and had no record of violent behavior or threats of violence to others. Plaintiff asserts that the tenant was an unsuitable tenant for the facility because of his mental illness and prior criminal conduct. However, the tenant's criminal conduct took place 15 years before this incident. Plaintiff argues that the facility lacked adequate security given its high-risk population. However, surveillance cameras controlling building access and functioning locks on office doors, which were present here, have been found to be sufficient to satisfy the minimal precautions standard. Furthermore, since the incident was over in less than a minute and security personnel were alerted and responded, additional security could not have prevented the incident. Next is the Nemeth case on pages 10 and 11. It's a toxic torts case involving asbestos. The First Department, in a comprehensive opinion by Justice Gish over a dissent, held there was sufficient evidence of causation to raise a jury question in this asbestos mesothelioma action. The issues addressed included general causation, specific causation, whether plaintiff's counsel's closing required a new trial, and the apportionment of damages. The opinion is far too detailed and comprehensive to fairly summarize here. The court wrote, "The Court of Appeals recognized that precise information and exact details are not always available in toxic tort cases, and they may not be necessary so long as there is evidence from which a reasonable person could conclude that the defendant's offending substance has probably caused the kind of harm of which the plaintiff complains." After each side's attorney highlighted the weaknesses in the other side's expert scientific evidence and authorities, it then became the province of the jury to weigh the evidence and decide which opinion was more credible. There is no legal basis to disturb the jury's findings and verdict in favor of plaintiff. There is no basis in this record for a finding that the weight of the evidence presented at trial preponderated in favor of finding no specific causation. Plaintiff's counsel's summation comments were isolated remarks during a very lengthy summation. They were not pervasive, egregious, or an obdurate pattern of remarks that inflamed the jury into believing that the focus of plaintiff's exposure to asbestos-contaminated talc was other than airborne particulates that she had breathed in for many years. Next is Guerin versus Robbins on pages 11 and 12. It's a traffic accident case involving a lawsuit by a passenger against a driver. The Third Department, over a dissent, held plaintiff passenger did not raise a question of fact about defendant driver's negligence in this traffic accident case. Plaintiff alleged defendant failed to keep a proper lookout when an SUV merged into defendant's lane and stopped. Defendant was able to stop without hitting the SUV, but was struck from behind by the Robbins vehicle. The court wrote, "Drivers have a duty to see what should be seen and to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances to avoid an accident. Where the lead driver is forced to brake and stop suddenly without striking the vehicle in front due to that vehicle coming to a sudden stop, there is no basis for imposing liability on that driver." Defendant testified at his deposition that he was driving in the right lane on a highway and that he saw the SUV move from the left lane to the middle lane. Defendant testified that as the SUV was in the middle lane, he looked to his right to see if he had an out to go because there was a vehicle to the left of him. The SUV suddenly jumped in front of defendant without flashing a turning signal, hit the brakes, and came to a complete stop. Defendant braked and avoided hitting the SUV. Shortly thereafter, however, Robbins struck the defendant's vehicle in the rear. In view of this, defendant satisfied his moving burden by establishing that he was not negligent. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this April 2020 negligence update CLE. The verification code is SUV. Again, the verification code for this April 2020 negligence update CLE is SUV. The final case is on pages 12 and 13. It's Cable versus State of New York. It's another traffic accident case, this time involving a police vehicle. The Second Department held the reckless disregard standard applied to a police vehicle making a U-turn. Plaintiff motorcyclist alleged he lost control of the motorcycle because he was forced to brake when the officer, whose name was Belletto, pulled out from the shoulder to make the turn. Believing it was safe to do so, the officer made the U-turn to respond to another officer's call for assistance. The state's, that's the defendant's, motion for summary judgment was properly granted. The court wrote, "On the night of June 2, 2017, New York State Trooper Daniel Belletto was operating an emergency vehicle. He pulled onto the right shoulder of the northbound Palisades Parkway near exit 12 to issue a traffic ticket to the driver of the vehicle. When Belletto was finished, he drove his vehicle onto the roadway to make a U-turn to respond to a radio dispatch regarding a trooper in need of assistance. Before pulling out from the shoulder, he observed the traffic conditions and believed that the approaching northbound vehicles were sufficiently behind him and that it was safe for him to execute a U-turn. To reach the southbound Palisades Parkway, Belletto had to traverse two northbound lanes and a grassy median. When the emergency vehicle was partially in the median, Belletto heard a noise. According to the claimant, that's Edward Cable, he was traveling on his motorcycle in the right northbound lane when he saw the defendant's vehicle pull out from the shoulder. Fearing an impact, the claimant applied his brake, lost control of his motorcycle, and fell off. The emergency vehicle never came into contact with the claimant or his motorcycle. The claimant and his wife, suing derivatively, commenced this claim against the defendant. The claimants moved for summary judgment on the issue of liability. They argued that Belletto's conduct should be evaluated by ordinary evidence, the ordinary negligence standard, and not the reckless disregard standard set forth in Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1104, since Belletto was not engaged in one of the activities enumerated in Vehicle and Traffic Law 1104B at the time of the incident. The defendant cross-moved for summary judgment dismissing the claim. The defendant argued that Belletto was involved in an emergency operation at the time of the incident, and that Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1104B4 applied since Belletto was attempting to make an illegal U-turn. The defendant also argued that Belletto did not operate the emergency vehicle in reckless disregard for the safety of others. The Court of Claims denied the claimant's motion and granted the defendant's cross motion. Then the claimants appealed. The court wrote, "The reckless disregard standard of care in Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1104E only applies when a driver of an authorized emergency vehicle involved in an emergency operation engages in the specific conduct exempted from the rules of the road by Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1104B. Any other injury-causing conduct of such a driver is governed by the principles of ordinary negligence. Conduct exempted from the rules of the road by Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1104B, includes disregarding regulations governing the direction of movement or turning in specified directions." Here, the defendant established that by attempting to execute a U-turn in response to another trooper's radio call for assistance, Belletto's conduct was exempted from the rules of the road by Section 1104B4. And that, as a result, his conduct was governed by the reckless disregard standard of care in Section 1104E. The defendant also established that Belletto did not operate the emergency vehicle in reckless disregard for the safety of others. So that concludes this April 2020 negligence update CLE.